Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Eduardo Fernandes Duque. He is professor of anthropology at the School of Arts and Sciences, with a secondary appointment at the School of the Environment at Yale University. He is a biological anthropologist with a general interest in understanding the evolution and maintenance of social systems, and today we're focusing mostly on mating systems in primates, biparental care, cooperative breeding, natal dispersal, and some other related topics. So, Dr. Fernandes Duque, welcome to the show. It's a big pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Ricardo. It's a pleasure. The pleasure is mine. It's been an impressive program that you've been developing over the years, so I'm honored to be joining the host of speakers you've had in the past. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. And so, to start off with, what different kinds of mating systems do we find across primate species exactly?
Before I answer specifically that, I'd like to make the distinction. It's going to help us in our conversation later on between social systems and mating systems. And this is one of those times when maybe relating it to humans really helps us get the message across. So we always try to be very careful when we move between monkeys and humans. But a social system, it's the kind of situation in which individuals of the different sexes and different ages interact with each other socially, behaviorally, demographically, but without any explicit reference to where they are mating with each other, whether they are having sex with each other or not. So when we talk about a mating system, we're referring to, in a very general sense, who has sex with whom. And again, further on, I suspect we will be elaborating a little bit more on the differences between having sex and actually reproducing with each other, but we can come back to that later. So if we're going to talk about who has sex with whom, who mates with whom in primates, you have them of all kinds. Most people are very familiar with those species where you have several adult males and several adult females, and they're all mating with all of, I mean, with each other. There are patterns, of course. Sometimes a male will concentrate most of the mating opportunities, and other males may not be so lucky. But usually, most of the females do have access to mating. So we talk about those groups as being multi-male, multi-female mating systems. We may also refer to them as polygynous, meaning that one male has access to many females. We have in primates as well a system that's very rare in most animals, definitely rare in primates and in humans, which is a system where a single female may mate with many males, polyandry. And it's in primates, we only see it in some relatively small primates, monkeys of South America. And then we have another system, which is the system where I have focused my research, which is a system where there is monogamous mating, meaning that there's only one adult male mating with one adult female. It is usually the case that when that happens, those animals also have some kind of socially monogamous system. They are just spending time with each other. So that in a nutshell, it's a little bit the range, bigger variation that we see in primates for mating systems.
And what do we know about the factors that influence mating systems in primates? That is, if, for example, in a particular species we find that polygyny is dominant or monogamy is dominant or any other kind of mating system, what are the factors that influence that exactly?
So it would have been interesting to have my response to that question, say 5, 7, 10 years ago. It would have probably been different from what I'm going to say now. I am finding myself in the last many years immersing more and more into what is known as the causal revolution, reading and teaching and writing about causal inference. I'm trying to really embrace the uncertainty that comes from the research we do in primatology. Most of our research is observational, therefore, really talking about factors that influence, sometimes convey to the public, an understanding that we have about the relationship between presumed causes and effects that we do not have. So having made that clarification that we're going to be talking about factors that influence what we really mean when we study primates, living primates in an ecological setting, is what are some factors that we see happening in a certain relationship, in a certain association with these mating systems that we observe.
Right.
Having made that clarification, which sometimes, of course, we're talking about mating systems in primates, maybe it isn't that serious if we do not get the causal pathway correctly, but it is profoundly important, the misunderstanding we have in making causal inference claims for very, very important social matters that we're interested in. So
Right.
what are some of the factors? The typical culprits have been, of course, all kinds of social and environmental factors. And a very, very general hypothesis that it is so general that you cannot really test it adequately is that when you have resources that are distributed in space in a relatively homogeneous manner, that may be a situation that lends itself to a higher probability of having a monogamous mating system. Why? Because in mammals, and this is very, very important, in mammals, let's not forget that male and females have very, very different reproductive biology. Females have a pregnancy and females lactate. Males do not. And so I think a very reasonable assumption is that that conditions so much of the social systems and mating systems of all mammals, primates included. So if the resources, say food, are evenly distributed in space, the assumption is that it is likely that females will distribute in space also evenly because they all need similar amounts of food. And it is the distribution of females in space that may condition, that may influence, if we allow ourselves to speak in that matter, how males may seek females and how males may organize themselves spatially, socially, in terms of mating with females. So we look at the environment to understand patterns of mating systems. Then, of course, you always have in these questions the egg and the chicken challenge, because what comes first is very, very difficult to disentangle in living systems. And so there's a lot of data suggesting that it is more likely to have a monogamy in those systems where you can also recruit, engage the contribution of the male to the care of the young. Because once you get that, we're going to be talking about that soon later on, by parental care or paternal care, then there are higher benefits to both the male and the female from sticking together than if the male were just to mate with one female now and with the second one later. So we look at social factors, we look at ecological factors, we look at environmental factors. When I'm referring to factors that we can actually measure in real time in the field.
And when it comes to monogamy specifically, there's this distinction between social and genetic monogamy. So, what's the distinction and why does it matter?
Distinction is, again, very, very simple to understand. For us humans, there is a difference between with whom you have sex and with whom you have kids, raise them, protect them, and contribute resources. So, before the genetic revolution, and by that I mean what started occurring now more than 30 years ago, that we are able to obtain samples from the wild animals we study to do genetic analysis, before that, we had nothing but looking at who was mating with whom. So you would have found a group of owl monkeys with a lot of dedication. Maybe you were able to identify who is the male and who's the female. That's very, very difficult to do in this taxa because males and females look the same. And then you would conclude that male A only mates with female A. And so you would call that a social monogamy. You may also call it monogamous mating. But the truth is that we didn't know whether that mating really resulted in pregnancies and births. It was through studies of birds, which are primarily monogamous, most mammals are not monogamous, that we started learning about what has become in the literature called EPCs, extra pair copulations. And then we added fertilizations to that, because an extra pair copulation was described as, I see this female who is socially paired to this male, mating with a male outside the pair. That's an extra pair copulation. Before genetics, we couldn't still determine where that extra pair copulation led to having an infant. With genetics, we could. And we started seeing that a huge, huge numbers of bird species that had been described as socially monogamous were not genetically monogamous. It wasn't true that a male and a female were only reproducing with each other. They were mating with each other, but they were mating also with other males and other females. There have been attempts, I mean, people have done the same kinds of studies with all kinds of primate species, and that's how we learned that even in those systems that I was describing before, where you have many males and many females mating with each other, living with each other, many times you have substantial reproductive skew. What we mean by that is that it is usually one male who actually sires most of the young. Even when the others may be getting a bite here and there, they are not really carrying the weight of producing the next generation of individuals. We have several talks among primates that are pair living, where we see social monogamy. And we have some primates where people have evaluated genetic monogamy. Our project is probably one of the largest, if not the largest, attempt at characterizing social and genetic monogamy in a non-human primate. And much to our surprise, we have found that consistently for our monkeys in Argentina, it is just that male and that female who are sharing a space, who are sharing a home, who are sharing feeding activities that are only producing infants with each other. We have never ever, in all these years, and now we have evaluated over 100 pairs of putative infants and fathers, never have we found evidence of extra pair copulation. Always, the male to whom we assign paternity, it has always been the male that was in the group with the female at the time of conception and pregnancy. I have studied with colleagues in Ecuador, another socially monogamous primate, the titis, and Saki monkeys. We've studied this with my colleague Tony DiFiore, with Sergio Ambel, Maren Hook. We have looked at other primates, and in those cases, the evidence is not as unequivocal that you have genetic monogamy. In fact, our monkeys are today one of the very few mammal species where you just don't find any extra pair paternity. It remains a puzzle. I am not convinced. I mean, if you ask me, I bet my money that sooner or later we're going to find some data, some evidence suggesting that every so often there is some extra pair paternity. But so far, none that we have found.
And so at a certain point there, you mentioned pair living. So could you tell us a little bit more about what pair living is, and is it related in any way to pair bonding or not?
Pair living, and I think I didn't address before something that's going to be important for discussing pair living, why it matters, the distinction between social and genetic monogamy. It matters because it helps you understand the pair living. So, I mean, evolution depends on you passing traits that are inherited by the future generation, right? That's how traits become more abundant in the population, how they may become fixed or not. So really what matters, if there's some biological basis to the tendency to live in pairs, to focus your attention, your mating, and your reproduction with one single adult, be male or female, it needs to pay off in terms of reproduction, of fitness. That's where the genetic monogamy is important. What we mean by pair living is, now going back to the social system, is that consistently, everywhere people have looked at owl monkeys, everywhere people have looked at titi monkeys, from Panama down to Argentina, all the time we just find one adult male and one adult female. And they function very cohesively. They go about their lives very close to each other, traveling. I mean, most of the times, if you go to the forest in Ecuador, in Peru, in Argentina, you'll find titi monkey adults and owl monkey adults within 3 to 5 meters of each other, max. Every so often, they may be further away. So they're really close to each other. They are coordinating their activities. One is feeding, most likely the other one is feeding. One is sleeping, the other is sleeping. And very importantly, they're also coordinating and sharing parental duties. They take care of the young together. You ask a question about how pair living and pair bonding relate. Right. They relate a lot, but here is where I am guilty of sometimes having discussed pair bonding in owl monkeys in the field without really having the robust evidence for a pair bond that we may have for some pair bonding mammals in captivity. This is a good opportunity for me to discuss how important, how enriching it is to combine what you can learn from studying animals in the wild and what you can learn from studying animals in captivity. Owl monkeys function in the wild in a way that it is suggestive of having a very strong pair bond. When we talk about a pair bond, we are usually implying some kind of physiological process by which two individuals, let's talk first about a bond. People are very familiar with the bond between a mother and an offspring. Not so much familiar the bond exists between a father and an offspring. What do we mean by that? What do we mean by the mother-offspring bond? We mean that there's some physiological process by which those two individuals are emotionally attached. There is some extent of dependency of one on the other and vice versa. There is usually some anxiety, some stress if that relationship is terminated, right? Mm-hmm. The same happens with an adult male and an adult female in many bird species and in some mammal species, including the titi monkeys, that my colleagues, led by my former advisor Bill Mason, Sally Mendoza, and in the last 20 years, Karen Bales, have studied in great detail at the California Primate Center in the US. So we have evidence for titi monkeys that the male and the female are emotionally connected. They seek each other, they prefer each other, and they are stressed when they cannot count on each other. Do we have those data? Do we have the kind of detailed data my colleagues have for titi monkeys, which I studied back in the day? For the wild owl monkeys, no, we don't. But we allow ourselves to make the inference that their behavioral patterns seem to reflect what is probably a physiologically driven, maintained pair bond. The very, very rich but anecdotal evidence we have of this in the field is that for 20 years, we have regularly captured one of the two adults in the pair to feed them with a radio collar. And when that happens, when you take the male or the female from the pair, there's quite a fascinating response by the remaining adult who doesn't run away, stays near the place where we're doing the physical exam of his or her partner, calling. So that has been, we never planned this, it so happened we need to do it, that has been our little semi-experiment of disrupting the relationship and assessing how the partner left behind responded. So that's what I mean by pair living, pair bonding. We do see also behavioral evidence of what seems to be a very strong attachment of the infants to the fathers, something that we know as well from titi monkeys in the field and in captivity.
So I guess that perhaps this would be a good point to introduce the topic of biparental care, which is something that we've already been alluding to several times in our conversation. So what conditions favor the evolution of biparental care?
By parental care, of course, we're referring to a system of care where both parents provide care. very, very frequent, say, in birds, very frequent in fish, but not so frequent in mammals. But remember, birds and fish do not have a pregnancy, do not have lactation. So in mammals, like in primates, like in owl monkeys and titty monkeys, the expectation is that, okay, maybe we do not need a male, as long as the female carries on a successful pregnancy and then nurses the infant, that's all it takes. Because in fact, we do see that in a lot of other mammals where the involvement of the male is trivial or non-existent. But that isn't the case in titty monkeys, owl monkeys, and also calitrichids, which is another group of primates from South America. In this taxa, this range of species, the male is actively involved in providing care to the young. What is it that the male does? Well, you were asking, let me describe what we mean by parental care, then we'll get into what is it that may be favoring the evolution of this. Yep. In the case of owl monkeys and titties, it's quite remarkable. When I'm asked, what is the single, if I had to choose one single characteristic of owl monkeys and titty monkeys that makes them unique, I think it is, without any doubts, the commitment of the males to the care of the young. I know of no other mammal on earth where the males are as committed as fathers as titty monkeys and owl monkeys. Just from a few days after birth, the male will actively seek to engage, to interact with a newborn. For the first time in 27 years, now 18 months ago, we saw a live birth in the forest of Argentina, sometime around 11 in the morning. And for the first time from a wild group of owl monkeys, some assistants were able to see how the male was right there. It was like having the male in the same room, in the delivery room. The baby is not yet completely out of the mom's womb, and the father was there, licking, sniffing, interacting with mother and the infant. A few days after the infant is born, the male may also get closer to the female, and between them both, they may transfer the infant to the male. And I want to say a week, definitely 2 weeks after the infant is born, most of the times the infant will be transported, carried by the father. So here I'm using male and father. For the owl monkeys of Argentina, we can confidently call it the father. We know it is the genetic father. And that relationship goes on, and it goes on through infancy, through the juvenile period, even through sub-adulthood. We have very robust data showing that there is, from all these various stages of development, the young prefer to approach, to interact, to socialize with the father more than the mother. In fact, through research done by Dr. Alba Garcia de la Chica from Spain, who did her PhD and a postdoc with the Almaki project, her analysis has suggested that there are bigger consequences to the survival of the young when the father dies than when the mother dies. So that's what biparental care is, this very profound commitment of the male to providing care to the young, the male and the female coordinating. You need to be close to each other, right? Because it is still the female who carries on the burden of lactating. And we know that's energetically costly. So male and female really have to be pair living and coordinate their activities. If mom were nursing the infant, and when she's tired of it, the male were ranging a mile away seeking another female, it wouldn't work. You really need to have a two-person system at home. And so we think that, I go back to what I was saying before about the chicken and the egg, it's very, very different to disentangle what favors what. But when you look, another way in which we can make inferences is to look at the distribution of these phenotypes, of these traits, across the animal kingdom. And consistently, we see that it is much more likely that you get biparental care when there is pair living and pair bonding than the other way around. So evolutionarily speaking, phylogenetically speaking, there seems to be reasons to propose that you need to have coordination, pair living, pair bonding. Why? Because that means proximity. That means emotional connection. That maybe means faithfulness. Once you have those conditions settled, then it is much more likely that the male may be favored if you were to invest energy on the young, because by being close to each other, you reduce the chances of the extra pair copulations we were discussing before. If I have been with my partner all along, then the chances are much higher that I have actually sired that young. So evolutionarily speaking, it pays off that I invest energy in a young that I have sired, as opposed to maybe a mating system like we were describing at the beginning, where you have males and females mating with several members of the other sex. So for mammals that we looked at, when we examined some data in the literature, this was a study led by my colleague Maren Hook, where she reviewed the evidence we had for social monogamy, pair bonding, and parental care in mammals. It is usually when you have close pairs, as opposed to dispersed pairs, that it is more likely you get biparental care.
Right. And so when it comes to things that we've been talking about, like, for example, pair living, sexual monogamy, and biparental care, do we know if a sexual selection plays a role in their evolution?
Yes. So given I chose between yes and no, let's go with yes. We have decades and decades of research on sexual selection and with a range of taxa. And sometimes we know, or we allow ourselves to feel, that we have a very solid understanding because it has been shown in other taxa, in other systems, where it is much more likely to really make the manipulations that allow you to get closer at understanding the connection between sexually selected traits and a particular mating system. One of the areas where people have looked a lot at potential relationships between factors is body size dimorphism. We have a lot of data indicating that certain traits in males and females are sexually selected. It's very interesting that in pair living primates, we do not have a lot of sexual dimorphism. And so an argument has been made, and I think, again, there's a lot of data across taxa suggesting that maybe sexual dimorphism is related to sexual selection. We do not, I was saying before how difficult it is. We cannot really tell males from females without monkeys and titty monkeys. And this is just to give you an indication of how complicated it is. At the California Primate Center, where I did my PhD studying titty monkeys, even today, in captivity, where you're looking at the animals, say, from 2 meters away, they tag the males and females with different tags. It's an hexagonal tag for the males, I think, and a circular one for the females, because you can be standing in front of them and you cannot tell them apart. So we cannot do that either with the owl monkeys in the field. Now, going into the genetics of sexual selection, that is much more challenging, and that's where there's still so much that we need to do. Identifying traits for which we know the genetic basis that are related, for example, to the tendencies to provide care in males and females, we don't really have that information in owl monkeys or for any primate. The way in which we approach that is to look maybe at endocrinological profiles associated with parenting. In the calitrichids that I was mentioning before, that also have pair bonding and they also have paternal care, my colleagues, I'm thinking of Tony Ziegler, Chuck Snowdon, but I'm being unfair to so many of my colleagues who've done work with the calitrichids in captivity. They have shown that in these males that provide a lot of parental care, sometimes you have some of the same hormones and same hormonal levels that you see in mothers who are providing care. So it is a very reasonable assumption that there has to be some genetics underlying these hormonal profiles in males and females that are so similar in situations where the male and the female are both providing care. But it's still, I mean, behavioral genetics, as we call it, understand the true genetic basis of complex behaviors like infant care or pair bonding, we are still very far from understanding how those things, how those traits get selected.
So I would like to ask you now a little bit about cooperative breeding. On the show, I've already talked with several anthropologists over the years about cooperative breeding in humans, in human societies. I don't know if you also want to get a little bit into that, but does it also occur in other primate species?
Yes, it does occur. We can look back to the first question we were discussing, which was the range of mating systems we have in primates. And I remember I told you how, well, first, very basically, what do we mean by cooperative breeding? And of course, among us, biological anthropologists and primatologists, we can quibble like about that. We end up writing reviews about it. But for the purpose of having a fun conversation, let's decide that the definition is rather straightforward to me. Cooperative breeding. You have a number of individuals cooperating in the taking care, raising of the young in a given group. In some situations, people would argue that you have cooperative breeding where there's only one female who's the one reproducing, and then males in that group, but also relatives, siblings, and grandparents, and grandmothers, and grandfathers are all helping. We do see it not in our monkeys and the tiny monkeys. Let's address them first because they leave us with a very interesting topic that we have not fully explored. Siblings don't help in our monkeys and tiny monkeys. So you have your pair living species, mom, dad, a couple of, there's an infant, there's a toddler, and now you have some juveniles and some adults, and we just have no idea why their help is not recruited. It doesn't happen in captivity, it doesn't happen in the wild, it doesn't happen for titties, for our monkeys. But in other taxa, in the Calitrichids of South America, where mom may have twins with some frequency, and sometimes they may have twins a couple of times a year, the siblings help. And more than one male may help take care of those young. So yes, we do have the kind of situation that has been used to refer to cooperative breeding in humans. It takes a village, well, maybe not a village for the Calitrichids, but definitely more than mom and dad. Mom, dad, siblings, and some other females and males who may be related to those young. But for us, it's something we need still to explore. Why don't the siblings in our monkeys and titty monkeys contribute? It's interesting. I imagine they're probably better off just putting all that energy into growing healthy and preparing themselves for competing in securing their own mates in the future.
By the way, when it comes to cooperative breeding, and now we're talking mostly about other primate species and not so much humans, do we know if there is always necessarily some sort of genetic relatedness between the cooperative breeders and the infants, or not?
We don't have a lot of data for that in the Calitrichids, but there are some studies reporting that there is relatedness. I have to admit, the names of my colleagues who led those studies are escaping me. So we have some data for the Calitrichids in terms of relatedness. Now, with non-humans, what's interesting, I think, is that if people have asked me, if we were to swap, I mean, if you were able to take an infant owl monkey and remove it and bring a substitute, would it change? My guess is if you did it right away from the go, I'd be surprised if the father, if the male, doesn't take care of that young who is not now not his sire. Yes, we do have information on relatedness, and it because we know that sometimes it is, for example, in the Calitrichids, sometimes it is brothers who help take care of the twins that the female has sired. And sometimes we have in colored retreats that more than one male is really mating with a female. That's why I was saying before that in those systems we have what we call polyandry, the female mating with several males. So that would be a potential explanation for why those males may be helping, because again, there is a likelihood that they have sired those young.
And do we know exactly what predicts the evolution of cooperative breeding in particular species?
No, we don't know anything very precisely. That would be, no, but really, I mean, that's be another conversation we can have one day. We need to tone down. And so we go into the classroom and teach our entry-level students how science work and how science self-correct itself, and we get it wrong and we try again, but we seem to forget about those lectures when we write the papers. So no, I don't have my, I would, again, choosing between yes and no, I would say no, we don't. But so your question was, do we know effectively if cooperative breeding, repeat me the, how you
what,
the
basically
question?
What factors predict the evolution of cooperative breeding in particular species?
No, I think we, I'll try to answer it the same way that we explored what we know about the factors that may influence the evolution of pair bonding or monogamy. Right. And so in humans, it's been argued that because humans as a species have so many life history traits that are so profoundly different from life history traits in other species, it may have been that by having cooperative breeding that has completely redesigned the energetic balance of all the actors involved and may have allowed humans to have a rate of reproduction that's unparalleled with other taxa. People have argued that maybe that's the reason that you also have in the Khaled Richards, which have cooperative breeding, the production of twins. But the production of twins is such a rare event, at least for all the primates in the Americas, that it is my understanding that that is still an unresolved issue. So people have argued, have hypothesized that it probably is related to changes and the pros and cons and the trade-offs in life history traits of humans or other species with cooperative breeding in relationship to those where there is no cooperative breeding. But there have also been, again, it's making me think about your initial question on factors promoting monogamy for birds. People have examined the extent to which it is environmental unpredictability that may be related to the evolution of cooperative breeding in birds. Many, many possibilities, many hypotheses. It is possible that for us to get closer to a more a better predictive answer, we would have to narrow down the scope of taxa for which we're developing our hypothetical models. And instead of trying to understand the evolution of cooperative breeding in birds, it'd be interesting to see what we learn. Trying to going narrower and deeper, it's something that some colleagues are doing, of course.
So I have one more question about cooperative breeding here before we change topic. So, is there any evidence that cooperative breeding might favor in any way the evolution of enhanced social cognition or larger brains?
It has been suggested, and there have been hypotheses proposed on that. What is interesting, I am a little bit on the side of this intellectual, very interesting conversation. I have not really contributed any primary research to the debate. My impression is that it is not very clear, and things get much more complicated when you go outside primates and look at other taxa to understand if it is really that cooperative breeding is related to the kind of development of cognition and brain size that people have argued for primates. Comes to my mind studies by Alex Thornton and Cathy McLaughlin, who have argued that they have all kinds of evidence from, if I remember well, from captivity on birds, where maybe there is not as much data suggesting this. But I think, again, we'll probably make more progress in going smaller than bigger You cannot expect to have one explanation explain the whole diversity of these patterns. But I'm probably not as qualified to comment much on social cognition on larger brains. It's quite outside my area of interest and of expertise, definitely.
So let's get into the last topic of our conversation today, and I would like to ask you now about natal dispersal. What is that exactly?
Natal dispersal refers to the process by which an individual leaves the area where it was born, leaves, disperses from the area where it was born, the natal area. And it is a very important process in the life of an individual because it's going to have all kinds of consequences regarding its future social and mating interactions. Take it to an extreme. If you're born in a family and you don't disperse, if you say, I'm going to stay put, well, your opportunities for reproduction are going to be limited most likely to your father, your mother, and your siblings. And evolutionarily speaking, we don't have reasons to believe that would be an evolutionarily stable strategy. So animals disperse. And when they disperse, which of the two sexes disperses, or if both sexes disperses, it has been a very important area of research in behavioral ecology for all taxa. In monogamous, in pair living taxa, monkeys, primates, mammals, birds, you name them, the expectation is that both sexes ought to disperse. And that was the way it's been always considered in the literature because drawing from the bird literature, for a long time, the assumption was that these pairs were living together for very prolonged periods, right? They were pairing for life. And so, if the assumption is that the same male and the same female are pairing for life in this area, any offspring born to them ought to disperse so that they avoid mating with their parents. As we learned in birds and in other taxa, including primates, that pairs are not always long-lasting, it is possible that now males and females may not disperse because their parents have been replaced. We have looked at natal dispersal in great detail, in good part led by my colleague, Dr. Maggie Corley, who did her PhD and then continued doing all kinds of endocrinological, behavioral, and genetic analysis on natal dispersal. And in the case of our monkeys like Tiris, we know that both sexes disperse. It kind of makes sense. But what we're learning now, what we're trying to understand is what are the possible reasons, what are the possible factors influencing when to disperse? And this is just work that we're getting ready to publish. Finally, being able to look at the genetics. And what Maggie Corley found is that there seems to be a tendency for the animals to disperse sooner or later in relationship to who of the parents are still in the group. Something we didn't talk about when discussing owl monkeys and social and mating systems is that the owl monkey population in Formosa allowed us to discover something that has not been reported consistently in many mammals, which is the existence of floaters. The animals who disperse don't get to find a partner right away. But the range alone is like, mom, dad, I'm leaving. Okay, go. What are you gonna do? I don't know. I'm gonna move around and see if I find a partner. And so they move around and they try to find a partner. But the problem is that we do not have in the owl monkey population in Formosa anything like bars where these young adults moving around trying to find partners can get together and form a new family. So the solution the owl monkeys are playing out is that my way to find a family is to really kick out from a home the same sex adult who is holding control of that home. So a young adult male will challenge, fight, and sometimes kick out a stable reproducing adult male. And a young female will fight, challenge, and sometimes kick out a reproducing female. So now, if you are the young who is pondering, do I disperse or not? You may find yourself that your biological father is no more. Now you have a stepfather, or maybe you have a stepmother, or maybe you have both stepfather and stepmother. And so that changes completely, completely so many aspects of how we're examining behavioral patterns, demographic consequences of all these processes. Because what we're learning is that when, for an owl monkey, when the parent of the same sex has been, I'm sorry, when the parent of the opposite sex has been replaced, they tend to stay longer. I'm a female, and I'm pondering, should I leave home or not? And suddenly I realize that dad is not here anymore. Now there's a stepfather that presumably I'm not related to. So that stepfather may become a reproductive opportunity, I stay longer. So those are analyses that we haven't published yet, we're working on it, but they connect the process of dispersal, the timing of dispersal, with the genetics of group composition and inbreeding avoidance.
Okay, so let me ask you perhaps one final question then. I think that when talking about owl monkeys and the timing of their natal dispersal, you focus there mostly on social factors, right? Are there any other kinds of factors, like for example, ecological factors that might also play a role in explaining the timing of their dispersal?
Absolutely, and we did look into ecological factors and environmental factors. In our forest, it's probably not the ideal situation to examine those because we work in a very, very seasonal environment. So sometimes when things are so seasonal, there are some aspects of the life history of the animal that match. So you take the spring period. So the spring period is the period when the babies are born, but it's also the period when food is more abundant. So it becomes complicated to disentangle factors. But what we're finding is that the environment is not as a strong predictor of when the animals disperse as maybe some social factors. Mm-hmm. And of the social factors that we have been considering, it is really relatedness, which seems to be the more predictive factor than others. But even when we see dispersal all around the year in Argentina, dispersal goes down. The rate of dispersal is lower in the winter when temperatures are lower and there's less abundance of food, because one of the factors that seems reasonable animals in an evolutionary framework may have played a role is that you need to disperse at a time when you can cope with the disadvantages of not being in a social group. And one of the advantages of being in a social group can be things like thermoregulation. The Chaco region of Argentina gets cold, and in the winter you will see the animals huddling and sleeping together. Now if you're on your own, wandering around at night during the day in a cold forest, that may be a disadvantage that doesn't play to you in evolutionary terms, and the animals may be dispersing at a time when it's less challenging in terms of thermoregulation or in terms of finding enough food outside of your home.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, Dr. Fernandez Duque, just before we go, would you like to tell people where they can find you and your work on the internet?
Yes, we have a website for the Owl Monkey Project, and if you just type that, you'll come across that. And I do have my own personal website that also provides links to the project, to Fundación ECO. When I started my work in the province of Formosa in Argentina, we established Fundación ECO, which is an NGO that promotes education in the country. So you can also look there. But I think either my site or the Owl Monkey Project site should give you plenty of information. For the Owl Monkey research, I'm very proud to say that as of this month, in fact, I have just published an edited volume that summarizes 30 years of research on owl monkeys from Panama to Argentina. This is a book published by Springer, and it's available. The ebook is free of charge, and you can find all types of research that 60 colleagues of mine, we have all put together, spanning the research on owl monkeys that has been done from Panama down to Argentina, including also research led by my colleagues in the US who have been working with owl monkeys for a very, very long time. So the Owl Monkey book by Springer It's a wonderful resource and it's available free of charge as an ebook. You can find all you need about Almanac there.
Great. So I'm leaving some links to that in the description box of this interview. And Dr. Fernandez Duque, thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Ricardo. Pleasure joining you. And thanks for the time and the opportunity to share all this information about our research.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you liked it, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. And also, please consider supporting the show on Patreon or PayPal. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Perga Larsen, Jerry Mullerens, Frederick Sunda, Bernard Seixas, Olaf Alex, Adam Castle, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegar, Rui Inácio, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Phil Kavanagh, Mikkel Stormir, Samuel Andre, Francis Forte, Agnunes, Fergal Kossen, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Jonathan Labrant, João Linhares, Tantanti, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Eira, Tom Hummel, Sardes France, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londonho Correa, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavlo Stasevski, Nelek Bak, Guy Madison, Gary G. Alman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Paul Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litsky, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sonny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnault, Luke Loaki, Georgios Theofanos, Chris Williamson, Peter Wolosin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Erickson, Charles Murray, Alex Shaw, Maury Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry Dealey Jr., Old Herringbone, Sterry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Gracie, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dovner, Luke Nissen, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Galbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandon, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Benzliman, George Coriatis, Valentin Steinman, Per Crawley, Kate Van Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, B.R., Masood Ali Mohammadi, Perpendicular, Jonas Hertner, Ursula Goodenough, Gregory Hastings, David Pinsoff, Sean Nelson, Mike Levine, and Jos Necht. A special thanks to my producers, Isar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Tom Vanagden, Bernard Igni, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Giancarlo Montenegro, Alni Cortez, and Nick Golden, and to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, Bogdan Canivets, and Rosie. Thank you for all.